Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we explore America at 250 years old through lenses of migration, Black history, and queer liberation. Darius Bost and C. Riley Snorton discuss their book, A Black Queer History of the United States, and Anna O. Law discusses her book, Migration and the Origins of American Citizenship, African Americans, Native Americans, and Immigrants. Moderated by historian and author Valerie Gugala. This episode is the first of many to come from the 2026 American Writers Festival. Co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library, the American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 7th, 2026, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the next program in this space at the American Writers Festival. My name is Annie Allman and I'm the Administrative Associate at the American Writers Museum, and I'm excited to introduce our next writers. This program explores America at 250 years old through lenses of migration, Black history, and queer liberation. Darius Bost and C. Riley Snorton discuss their book, A Black Queer History of the United States, the first ever Black history to center queer voices. Anna O. Law discusses her book, Migration and the Origins of American Citizenship, which reveals the unmistakable effects of slavery and Native American dispossession in modern U.S. immigration policy. Historian and author Valerie Gugala interviews them about the stories American histories often leave out. Please welcome me in joining them to the stage.
Welcome to this panel. I'm so excited to be here hosting, and I'm sure our authors are excited as well, and I'm excited to talk about these really interesting books. So let's get into it. So I guess my first question, really to all three of you, is how has belonging been defined in the U.S. historically before the Reconstruction Amendments, and how does it differ from formal citizenship? You guys start with that?
Well, first, let me introduce myself.
Oh, I'm sorry, I should have...
Happy Pride. My name is C. Riley Snorton, and I co-authored this project with Darius Bost. We're both academics working in gender studies. I also teach in English. I love this question about thinking about definition of belonging, especially because I think there are clearly ways of kind of thinking about the kind of legal definition of belonging alongside other modes of maybe defining belonging. But our project, starting in colonial America and also in the time of slavery, the question of belonging is one that cannot be extricated from questions about freedom and particularly unfreedom. And so as we kind of thought about the arc of the project, you know, so much of this project wasn't about creating a progress narrative per se, but rather kind of thinking about what kinds of logics and conditions do Black queer people navigate in the U.S., and what kinds of strategies, what might Black queer ancestors offer for navigating kind of current political.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. I'm Anna Law from CUNY Brooklyn College, and I'm really excited about the interdisciplinary nature of our panel. We have gender studies people, we have English, and I'm from the field of political science and history and legal. No one has ever clapped for
my major.
All right. So belonging, and so as my fellow authors and academics have said, we think of citizenship today as formal belonging. And like them, I start in the colonial period. And slavery is usually not discussed in U.S. immigration policy history. There's this sad footnote. And, and there were enslaved people. Moving on, back to voluntary migration. So I wanted to tell the story of U.S. immigration legal history and policy history with Native American history and with African American history. In the early period, beginning in the colonial period, we don't have your rights and how well you are treated don't derive from your formal citizenship. That doesn't happen until after the passage of the Birthright Citizenship Clause in the 14th Amendment. So how well you were treated or how not well you were treated, what rights, privileges, protections you had derived from your race, whether your gender, whether you were poor or not, and whether you were an indigenous person or not. So we'll leave it there, and I'm sure we can elaborate on that.
Yeah. So to what extent do we, the people, have determining what the Constitution means and what rights everyone has?
Since my last name is Law, let me start. I don't have a JD. I am a constitutional law scholar. I have a PhD because the JD would have been redundant on top of my last name. So I'm glad you asked that, Valerie, because we are in a political moment where the Republican Party and apparently the Democratic Party and the Congress defer to the Supreme Court too much. The U.S. Constitution does not say who gets to interpret the Constitution. We, the people, also interpret the Constitution, not just the Supreme Court, not just those nine people. And if you look at U.S. history, which both of our books do, across U.S. history, you see ordinary people like me and you interpreting the Constitution in a broader, more inclusive way, and it has never been, and it never will be, only political elites telling us what the Constitution means. Normal people, when they fight against slavery, when they fight against indigenous dispossession, they are interpreting the Constitution too. So we have a long tradition of popular interpretation of the Constitution that I want people to remember and to be inspired by. And I think both our books, we try to do that, to remind people, don't defer to the Supreme Court. They are not the end-all be-all.
I think I would add that one of the things that we want to focus on is the fact that, you know, the sort of marginalization of queer and trans people, of Black queer and trans people in particular, is not just about their identities, but it's about what we have to say to America, how we are sort of criticizing some of the limitations and sort of exclusions of certain communities, but also the way that we've tried to hold the nation to its highest ideal. And so we wanted to focus on that and to focus on the ways that queer and trans people have contributed to sort of broader anti-racist movements and movements for queer liberation, to sort of talk about the ways that our voices have been excluded from both as well as from the nation at large. I think the other point for us is that by focusing on social movements, we also are sort of criticizing some of the dominant ways that LGBTQ people, and Black people, which is sort of notable given the Voting Rights Act, sort of Supreme Court decisions right now, is to talk about the limitations of rights and rights-based discourses because Black people, trans people, face multiple forms of harm, racism and homophobia that can't be legislated or shifted by the law. Sort of inclusion in certain communities within giving them the legal right to marry does not, as we can see now, get rid of homophobia. So we want to think about sort of more intersectional forms of resistance as, you know, some of the better ways to adhere to the goals and ideals of this nation.
You know, I was thinking I should have probably asked this next question first because it has to do with your research. Anna and I were talking just before, and she mentioned that it took her 16 years to write her book. I'm not sure how long it took you gentlemen to write your book, but what were some of your challenges writing it, or maybe some of your triumphs of finding something that what maybe you didn't know before or is really interesting. Anybody want to speak to that? Or
so Darius and I both have books that are thinking about blackness and queerness and located, at least in part, in the U.S. So my most recent single author manuscript, or monograph, is Black on Both Sides, A Racial History of Trans Identity. And so a lot of the archives for that work were very useful in the kind of collaborative writing project that we did together. So we spent about around 3 years co-writing, but this comes out of longer trajectories of working in these areas. And there were a number of challenges, I think. I mean, I would say challenges not in a way that was producing frustration, but challenges in something that had to be faced around writing as two folks trying to find a common voice. I think that, because we're part of the Revisioning History series, there was, a set of expectations about how we would narrate history. And one of the things that we do in the book is we try to give a feeling of history as cyclical rather than as linear. And that was something that we needed to kind of really work on developing how we might return to a moment to tell a different part of that story. So I'll pause. Maybe there's more that you want to jump in on.
I mean, and I think of sort of like having to produce a book of Black queer history in 3 years means, of course, that you have to deal with the fact that this could be a 16-year project,
yeah,
because there's so much.
Yeah.
So we had to deal with, what can we include and what do we exclude? Do we focus on figures that folks have not heard about, or do we try to give fresh perspectives on the folks people may have heard about? And, part of the thing is for us not to assume that people know any of this history. We also were grappling with the fact that we're both academics and we use academic language, and the press was really pushing us to get all of that jargon out of our writing so that it could reach a broader audience. Yeah, and so part of so this is really a kind of sweeping introductory history for us. It required that we sort of draw on some of the research that's already existing, some of our own research, and really sort of create a kind of a tighter through line, which is why, again, we've chosen to focus on sort of the long Black freedom struggle as our way of entering to think about sort of more social aspects and more some, other than like political as well.
So I understand why the organizers put our two books together, because our books have a lot in common. It sounds like we both did a synthesis, which is to combine the scholarship. Instead of reinventing the wheel, we are telling a story based on what other scholars have said. Both of us, I'm sure, have done original research and consulted primary sources as well. But why I took 16 years is I am trained as a political scientist, and I don't know the early history of the United States, the colonial period, the early republic. And so I had to learn it and do a lot of reading to lay down basic information to be accurate. I realized I can be accurate or I can be fast, but there's not doing both at the same time. And there is one standard of historical accuracy. No one is going to say, oh, she doesn't have a PhD in history, so she can be a little bit wrong. No, I'm going to get eviscerated by historians if I'm not accurate. So I read a ton. And very honestly, over 16 years, one of the challenges is waking up over and over again after, through 16 years. Many mornings I would wake up and say, am I finishing the book? Or is the book finishing me? And through sheer spite, I dragged myself across the finish line. I don't know how else to put it. Sheer pigheadedness and spite.
Yes. Yes, yes. Congratulations for that. I want to go back. You mentioned that there were figures that you were trying to decide whether or not to include them. Can you maybe expand on, maybe tell us a figure that you didn't include that you wish you could have, or maybe somebody that you included that you're like, oh, I should have left them out and put in somebody else instead? Anything like that.
Well, I was thinking about William Dorsey's Swan, former enslaved person in Washington, D.C. that used to hold balls in Washington, D.C. in that period, is considered one of the first folks to be arrested for cross-dressing, and also one of the first to resist the police. And, you know, if you're familiar with this history, part of the sort of overlaps between sort of Black and queer histories of the United States is a sort of constant presence of police power. And so throughout, we have to deal with the carceral state and the way that sort of both legal and extra legal kinds of regulation did not permit people to sort of be themselves or have expansive sort of gender and sexual possibilities in the public sphere. And so I think starting with Swan, not starting with Swan, but Swan both sort of gives a kind of evidence of the existence of a gender and sexual non-normativity during slavery that is not, that is in the historical record, but you have to do a lot of sort of finessing to be able to talk about it. And also sort of gives us a kind of push to a Black queer history of the United States as a history of resistance.
Yeah, I think what I was thinking about, I think William Dorsey Swan is another example of that, is that so often in the book we turn to cultural workers for their political work. And, you know, the book kind of opens with a meditation and a riff on Marlon Riggs' Black Is, Black Ain't as a way of also highlighting for readers the expansive ways that we are talking about Blackness and taking up Blackness. But I think in moving through cultural movement alongside social movement, you know, there's just like so many performers that are not in this text. You know, there's a chapter called Work, which really kind of retells the 20th century Black queer history through musicians only. And so, you know, we kind of deal with Josephine Baker and Bessie Smith and kind of round it out with Janelle Monáe at the end of that chapter, but trying to tell a story about, you know, like Jim Crow segregation vis-a-vis their travel and itinerary or the kind of expat movement that Josephine Baker and James Baldwin, so many others who elected to leave because of the unfreedoms that they were experiencing as part of the daily texture of their lives. So I think so much about, you know, like there we could have taken on a task equally to say we're looking at writers only for that chapter, or we're looking at, you know, dramaturgs. There's just such an abundance for me at the nexus of cultural political work. And many places in the book we try to gesture toward the unfinished nature of what it means to do this kind of survey.
And was there anything that you wish you had in your book that's not in it?
So I had a similar problem with if you do a synthesis, and my book covers the colonial period to 1888, and to fly at a 30,000-mile cruising altitude, I had to make decisions about what to include and what to exclude. And every time I give a book talk, someone will ask me, well, what about the Irish and the Italians? Weren't they discriminated against with their freedom of mobility into and across the country? I said, yes, but the time period my book covers, colonial to 1888, is the stretch of time over 100 years where the colonies and then the states had control over international and interstate borders. Huge reason why? Slavery. Can you imagine telling the slave states the federal government's going to have deportation power? John Adams tried to do that. The slave states freaked out and said, no, you're going to deport all our enslaved people. So the local state laws that I looked at, there are no laws restricting the mobility internally and internationally of Irish people or Italian people. The two groups of people that are the most restricted with the most laws are free and enslaved African Americans coming into and across the country and poor people. Were other groups restricted? Yes, Mormons. But, you know, that's a group that I had to leave out, and it's because I'm covering, based on the historical evidence, what are the laws, what are the groups that I see restricted in their mobility over and over and over in different states? And those are the two groups.
This kind of ties into that. What was the most surprising discovery that you made researching and writing?
I don't know. I just think about how difficult it was for us we've been doing this work for so long, you know, doing kind of interdisciplinary historical scholarship, and then trying to sort of do this work that was a synthesis project was much harder than I thought it would be. Even trying to sort of put together, you know, all of these disparate pieces that people have talked about, as well as sort of create our own narrative arc. And so for me, I don't know how else to say it, but it just was extremely difficult to sort of go back and try to sort of take what we know and put it into a kind of book like this, and not be able to talk about it in the way that we normally do. And without it sort of not wanting to use the language of simplify, but the kinds of complexities that, you know, we might take up through sort of academic language, we weren't able to do in this particular work.
Yeah, I think this is very quick, which is to say, I think part of what we were trying to brace ourselves for ongoingly is different terrains of politicization of the very terms that we're using. So I think that there's both a kind of moving from academic to general audience, but I think there's also writing about Black queer and trans life in a moment where there's so much concerted effort about narrowly defining who is or is not queer and trans in this moment.
Yeah. So I have the most surprising thing was halfway through the book. At the beginning of the book, I knew I had to learn African American history and the history of slavery. If I'm writing a book about federalism and law, I knew I had to learn that, so I did. But halfway through the book, I realized I need to learn federal Indian law and Native history. And so that was very surprising to me, because Native Americans are not migrants. They are the original landowners and occupants of the country. So what are they doing in a book about migration? The most surprising thing I learned is that the people of those earlier time periods, early Republic, 19th century, saw the groups of people who could migrate and who could stay where they wanted as relational. So congressional leaders and state leaders saw Native Americans in certain parts of the country in the Southeast in the 1830s as being in a space that they wanted, because enslavers wanted to expand the growth of cotton and therefore slavery as well. So the states goaded the federal government into paying for and executing the mass deportation of 80,000 Native people in 1830. So you probably know the Trail of Tears in the Cherokee. That is 16,000 people already. But in total, it was 80,000 people. So what was surprising to me is that groups of people and their ability to stay where they wanted on their ancestral lands for Native Americans was relational to whether other people wanted that land.
So both of these books have been published during renewed debates over immigration and birthright citizenship. So how does this history help us understand the current policy debates that are going on?
So people keep telling me how timely my book is. And so you guys know I didn't game this thing out, because I started didn't start 16 years ago and be like, what's going to be the hot topic that I can drop a book 2 weeks before the Supreme Court takes up oral argument on the constitutionality of birthright citizenship. Woo! no one who wrote a book about slavery wants to be relevant in the current moment. And yet here we are. Yeah. So what can my historical book say about the current moment? We need to understand, as Americans, why the Birthright Citizenship Clause was passed. What were the people who wrote the 14th Amendment trying to address? Guess what they were not trying to address? Birth tourism and illegal immigration. That wasn't a thing in the 19th century. That's not what they're dealing with. What they're trying to do, the framers, is to address the discrimination against free and formerly enslaved Black people from state discriminatory laws. And to make clear that free Black people and all Black people are U.S. citizens, period. That is the problem they were trying to address. Trump is currently trying to project back in time political debates and priorities that the people who ratified and wrote the 14th Amendment are not addressing. And so that's why we need this earlier history. I mean, the Supreme Court says they're originalists. I don't think so, but if they get it wrong, at least we know the history.
I just think that it we just can't forget the way that sort of gender and sexuality intersects with immigration struggles and around sort of freedom of movement writ large. You know, one of the things that we talk about are the William and Ellen Craft and the fugitive slave narrative, and to think about what it means to sort of cross-dress for one's racial freedom, and to sort of even imagine the possibility that that kind of gender transgression might also be one that is a site of freedom. But it also reminds us, which is something that we take up throughout the book, is that it could be, or it reminds us also that projects for racial freedom are also projects for gender and sexual freedom, even sort of current understanding of immigration and how it's being shaped. One, there are Black immigrants who are facing the same kinds of restrictions, and there are queer and trans immigrants who have particular concerns around detention and detainment. And so, you know, we can't afford to sort of go back and have a kind of singular understanding of what these concerns are, and not to think about other compounding forms of marginalization that are shaping the way that we think about the immigration debate.
All right. I think, Aetna, you kind of touched on this, of not knowing the early history of U.S. migration and citizenship. What are consequences of that, and who feels those consequences?
So the Supreme Court can rule how it rules, and they can write decisions and opinions based. One example is in Trump v. Barbara, which is the birthright citizen case. And I listened to the oral argument, and Justice Gorsuch was saying, well, you know, there's no immigration enforcement before the Civil War and the amendments. And I'm screaming in my head because I spent 16 years writing a book about state-level immigration laws. If we don't know that history, then we believe him. And enough of us know that history that he's wrong. But I didn't write this book to persuade the Supreme Court. They are going to rule how they are going to rule. I wrote this book hoping that everyday citizens will read it and understand that if the court rules the other way, that the court is wrong, they are illegitimate, and the court needs reform. And there is a right and wrong answer. There are right and wrong answers in history. There are parts of history where professional historians will say we don't have enough evidence and we don't know. But the meaning of birthright citizenship is not one of them. Good. And so that's why I needed to write as clearly as I could. I lied to my commissioning editor. He said, who's the audience for this book? I said, oh, academics that study political science and history. I lied. I dumped all the jargon because I wanted smart lay people like my undergrad students to understand it. So half the battle of the book was, once I understood it, I took another, you know, number of years to figure out, I understand it, but how do I explain it to smart lay people to bring them along to understand this as well?
So what do you hope readers understand differently after finishing your books? I think that kind of answered it in a way for you. But
yeah, I mean, I'm still thinking, too, about what writing this book meant in terms of the question of audience. And, you know, as we've been, the book just came out in January, late January. And so in the book talks that we've been doing, we often find ourselves with folks coming who are archivists, who are kind of working in a rapidly de-financialized or under-resourced forms of public education, whether that's in libraries or public schools. And, you know, often we talk about the kind of desire in writing the book is in writing a usable past. I mean, you know, I think so much about this contemporary moment as a Black trans person where at state and federal levels and globally in some instances as well, there's a real concerted effort to legislate transness out of existence, to make it legally impossible to be trans. And so much of what it means to then write a usable past is actually about also understanding that there were concerted efforts prior to this moment, and to understand that what makes trans community possible, trans affirming space possible, has often been in much more grassroots and local situations or spaces. And so it's really, you know, I think about it as part of a revisioning history story. So there's a lot that's also in a queer history of the United States, or Black women's history of the United States, or Black and Indigenous history. So we do think of our work as like related to those other projects that have come out here. But in a political moment where I think it can't be understated what kind of pressure there is on Black queer and trans people.
I mean, I guess I just want to say, and it's been something that I'm grappling with on so many levels, is that it's good to be on this panel that's thinking about the United States at 250, because I want people to take away that this is not just a siloed history, that we're not just speaking to one another, but to think about how Black, queer, and trans people have something to say about freedom and something to say about justice, that, you know, if we continue to marginalize their voices, then we might miss some of the lessons that they have to teach us. I'm not trying to claim a kind of universality. Cultural particularity is so important to this project, but I do think they have something broader to say to all Americans. Yeah. And I hope people will take that seriously.
So how has the understanding of queer identity changed over time? And what should your readers keep in mind when examining the historical figures through a modern lens?
I mean, there was an earlier question. I think one of the things that we have to grapple with in terms of starting with slavery and starting with the history of this country in colonial America is that the way that it has been constructed was actually sort of Black people were the kind of constitutive outside, right? Purported subhumanity are sort of the stereotypes that are attached to Black bodies and people were the things that allowed for sort of Europeans to construct their sexuality and their kind of moral norms, even if they were using sort of gender and sexual violence to maintain their claims to morality and to enforce kinds of racial difference. And so, you know, one of the things that we are trying to grapple with in the book is that we have to talk about sort of the way that sort of Black folks on their arrival in 1619 were sort of marked as this kind of denigrated caste permanently and sort of marked by these narratives of projection of sort of sexual deviance and stereotypes that was so connected to the construction of European settlers. Sexuality and identity. And so, you know, how do we think about in this moment where there are sort of possibilities for kind of consensual queer sexual relations and gender expansiveness when historically, histories of Black sexuality have been of violation and domination. And also to sort of take up the fact that part of the reason why these kinds of histories have been marginalized for so long is because Black people in their claims to kind of citizenship, full citizenship, have taken up a stance of morality that have meant that they had to distance themselves from anything that looked like the kind of deviance that has marked our bodies in the past. So for us, I think, you know, one of the things we are trying to do is to sort of grapple with this kind of meaning of Blackness as a denigrated class and how to reimagine Blackness and Black history as one that has the sort of, where Blackness contains the possibility of gender and sexual freedom, gender and sexual expansiveness. That's what we have to grapple with first if we're ever going to imagine something like a sort of pairing sort of Black sexuality and modern notions of gender and sexual identity.
So, Anna, not about queer identity, but how has understanding of immigrants changed over time, and what should readers keep in mind when looking at historical figures from modern times?
So there's something I like that my co-panelist said a minute ago, and it's about breaking down silos. There are intellectual silos and academic silos. So we work in three different departments. And even in the field of U.S. history, there is U.S. immigration history, there's legal history, political history, Native history, African-American history. And these are the ways that disciplines are organized for administrative purposes and for the purpose of making academic journals, but they get in the way of our knowledge acquisition. So both of our books, in our own ways, have cut across the silos. And the thing that I hope people walk away from reading my book is understanding African Americans' history is not a different history from U.S. immigration history. It is the same American immigration history, and Native Americans are a part of that story too. Not that because they are migrants, but because they are subject to state-sponsored forced deportation. African Americans who are enslaved are not immigrants, but they are subject to forced migration and control under the laws once they get here.
So your book emphasizes that LGBTQ people have always been a part of American society. How does recognizing that long history change the way we understand the broader American story?
Around this kind of question of siloing and what some of the Black queer folks that we spend time with in the book tell us about the central ideas of America's founding around life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I mean, one of the folks that I think about a lot is Joan Jett Black, who has a relationship to Chicago, who ran against Mayor Daley, who eventually becomes a presidential candidate, who's a Black drag queen performer, and who really poses critical questions over the 90s, principally around, you know, about the uneven level of access to these kind of central principles. And so I think, you know, so much of this book is about what does it mean to think about life and liberty from the place of being compoundingly excluded from some of these institutions that are meant to facilitate and to offer access to the kind of life of the so-called American dream. Yeah.
And immigrants, as you've said, have always been part of the American story. But maybe people didn't look at the immigrants that you've written about, you know, so how does recognizing the long history of immigration, how does that help change maybe the way that we look at American history?
So you've all heard the phrase, the United States is a nation of immigrants. Not a fan of that phrase. It erases Native Americans who are already here, and it glosses over how people came to this country, under what legal status they came, and because what legal status they came in then dictated the number of rights and privileges and material incentives. So for people who were rich enough to come during the colonial period by themselves, these colonies and early American states were giving away 50 to 100 acres of land for everybody who came. So think of that, that if your ancestors were rich enough to come, they didn't really pull themselves up by the bootstrap. They're thrown land and tax holidays. Think of if your ancestor was an indentured servant, they arrived under very different legal regimes, didn't free land. If your family member was an enslaved person, these histories have ramifications for the trajectory of families' accumulations of political power and generational wealth. That's why we need to understand the earlier history, I think.
So with your book, with the political climate right now, did you get any pushback on the topic of your book, or people saying you shouldn't be writing something like that? Or, I mean, with the way the world is today, I can imagine you probably did. Is that anything you want to speak to?
I think we were nervous about doing this kind of work. I'm sure you're, maybe, I don't know, you're aware of what's happening at universities with the sort of anti-DEI stance, and it's happening at more places than you think. It's not just in Texas. It's happening at the University of Illinois Chicago, where I teach. And for us, I'll just give one example. For people who are going up for tenure, their files were taken back in the middle of the process because they have diversity statements in them, and they were pulled. And this, I mean, if you know anything about tenure, it's like the moment where universities are most liable to be sued if anything goes outside of policy. And so they actually risked that liability so that they would not be subject to sort of legal scrutiny, and all the decisions are being made around risk management, and the lawyers at the University of Illinois system are really making decisions for us now. I say that to say that even if you are sort of removing DEI statements from your tenure statement, it also made people fear that the kind of work that they are doing that might be conflated with DEI work is not valuable to the institution, or one could be penalized for doing that kind of work. So at an institutional level, but also at a level outside of that, where professors are being monitored and watched and surveilled and put on watch lists, it is, you know, difficult for us to think about that. I would say in another way, I had this concern. Riley did not have this concern. I would say that the press is just, and the reception that we've had means that people are hungry for this even more because of the kind of repression of this knowledge. But at the same time, I feared what it would mean for us to have a kind of critique of rights in a moment when rights are being taken away. But I think it still holds that the sort of perspective that we are offering, which is that we need something that is not necessarily dependent upon the state, which has been sort of one of the biggest sort of contributors to the marginalization of these folks for our own freedom. So I have that concern about what it means to be critical in this moment, but also the concern about what it means to be doing work that's considered DEI work in a moment of the kind of anti-DEI sentiment that is having very real repercussions for faculty and students right now.
Are you facing any of that?
So I want to call the attention to the audience that the work that all of us do on this stage, our research agendas are illegal in multiple states now. I expect that my book will, I'm a scholar of race, and I have the privilege of tenure, and it is much more protection than contingent faculty have. I have the protection of being in a blue state and a blue city, but as you pointed out, in a blue state, blue city, you still got pressures on the board of trustees or donors, and I have the same fear of, what if I'm giving a lecture in class about race one day and a student surreptitiously records me, and it ends up on some YouTube. I've already ended up on a conservative list, this blogger list, who found one of my syllabi many years ago and put me on the top 10 most dangerous college professors, even though he never took my class, never set foot in my class. But there was one book on my syllabus that he didn't like. And I didn't have tenure then, and that was really scary because I didn't know whether my institution was going to deny me tenure because I was, you know, a problem. And of course, my other tenured colleagues were all jealous, and they said, how'd you become the most number one, most dangerous? You know, I teach Hitler, and I teach Osama bin Laden's writing. I said, you know what, not everybody can be the most dangerous. Sorry, you go self-nominate yourself.
Wear it as a badge of honor. I got the signal that we're going to have to wrap up, so I want to thank all three of you for being here. Your books are fascinating. Yes. And thank you to everybody for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.